Rumors with Ryan and Ryan. I'm Ryan Hulsa.
And I'm Ryan Quinn.
And today we're going to go into an overview of the management of rectal cancer, primarily with a focus on the localized setting.
We will not be going over metastatic rectal cancer because it's treated the same way as metastatic colon cancer. So for more details on the treatment of metastatic rectal cancer, just refer to our metastatic colon cancer episode.
Yeah, metastatic rectal cancer is kind of viewed as a left-sided colon cancer when it comes to management. First off, as a little disclaimer, we usually put this at the end of the episode, but please, if you have any questions or comments, please reach out to us by Twitter or email. If you've been listening to the podcast and you think it's going to be helpful for other fellows, please share it with those you know in training. And if you have some time, please place a review that helps us get discovered by other people interested in the topic.
And good luck to everyone that's just started their fellowship. We know it's an exciting time.
All right, so the bulk of today's discussion will be looking at the localized disease and some unique considerations. Just one thing worth noting is the metastatic pattern for rectal tumors is a little bit different than that for our general colon cancer, and there's a higher propensity for lung. Liver still remains the primary source of distant metastases, but lung is much higher for rectal compared to other side of colon cancer, which is related to the vascular supply there and the hematogenous spread.
There is an increased risk of local recurrence in rectal cancer as opposed to colon cancer. And just reviewing the anatomy, one of the reasons why this could be is that the rectum is retroperitoneal, so there's no peritoneal covering around the rectum. The disease can spread locally more easily.
This is the most distant part of the colon cancer. You'll often hear this measured as the distance from either the anal verge or the dentate line. The exact range of the distance from these diseases will vary by patient, as not everyone's anatomy is identical. But in general, we consider the rectal region to be anywhere from 3 centimeters to about 15 centimeters from the anal verge. And classically, this is broken down into clinically relevant thirds, with lower rectal cancers being about 3 to 6 centimeters, mid rectal cancers being 5, maybe 6, up to 8 or 10 centimeters, and higher rectal cancers being around 8 to 10, as far as up to 15 centimeters, with higher rectal cancers starting to verge more into our descending colon.
So once you have someone that you suspect that has rectal cancer, it's usually diagnosed via colonoscopy with biopsy. So the next question is, what other imaging do we need for staging? And clinical staging is usually done with CT, chest, abdomen. And in terms of the pelvis, you really want an MRI of the pelvis. This gives a better view of the anatomy, the invasion of the tumor into the depth of the wall, as well as local lymph nodes. Now, other than an MRI pelvis, the other option that you do have is an endorectal ultrasound. And this is really operator dependent. So some centers rely more on the MRI. Some centers that I guess have a good ultrasound technologist will use the endoscopic or endorectal ultrasound.
Yeah, there's some pretty clearly defined definitions of clinical staging, but based upon MRI or endoscopic ultrasound findings, based on the depth of the tumor, invasion locally, regional lymph nodes. When you read this on any of the publications describing how to stage the disease or maybe even a clinical trial, it sounds very straightforward. However, in practice, this is actually not that easy to be done. And the standard approach to all of these tumors, partially because of the difficulties to diagnose as well as variations in management, is all rectal cancer should be discussed at a multidisciplinary tumor board. And that would be the standard of care guideline.
It's also important when you're ordering the MRI pelvis to make sure that you specify to the radiologist that this is for rectal cancer staging. Because when you're looking at rectal cancer, they do very thin slices so that they can get a better look at the anatomy. And unless they know that they need to do this, they may not protocol it for rectal cancer. I've seen this happen a few times, and then they end up having to repeat the study. So always important to let our radiology colleagues know exactly what we're looking for.
And as with our usual disclaimer, this is not a surgical podcast, but I think it's worth being aware of the generalities about the different surgical options, as this will often be discussed in tumor board and ultimately it will impact the management decision that's used. You'll hear about 3 different kind of methods of surgical resection, and historically the standard was the APR, or the abdominal peritoneal resection. This is, although an effective way to resect the tumor as well as the surrounding lymph nodes, is a highly morbid procedure and requires a permanent ostomy in place. Therefore, the more modern approach is to try to find ways to remove the tumor using a sphincter-sparing approach. And what do we mean by sphincter-sparing? Well, we mean that when they do the surgery, they are able to preserve the anal sphincter, which allows for bowel continence. When the tumor is higher up in the rectal, one of those upper rectal that we mentioned, this can actually be done with a standardized low anterior resection, which was used for distal colon cancers. Lower rectal cancers, this is not so much an option due to the crowded anatomy, as well as challenges performing a low anterior resection, allowing for a safe anastomosis. The modern approach, when feasible, is called the transmesorectal excision. And this is essentially the removal of the rectum, as well as all the surrounding tissue, colloquially named the mesorectum. And this is the area that's paid close attention to during our radiology discussions. And you'll often hear the term of a threatened mesorectal border, as this might be a tumor that's pushing through this fatty layer of tissue. Within the mesorectum is where all the lymph nodes reside. So when we do these resections, we're in theory removing all the local lymph nodes.
So as with other cancers, the staging system that we use for rectal cancers, the TNMs. In terms of T staging, this is something that you'll see on the pathology report, with T1 meaning that the tumor invades into the submucosa, T2 involving the muscularis propria, T3 is the perirectal tissues, T4 is going through the wall of the colon, and then N being, you know, involvement of the lymph nodes, and M being distant metastasis. An interesting thing with rectal cancer is that a T4B lesion, which can be characterized as a stage 2, actually has a worse prognosis than a lesion with a lower T stage and a higher node stage.
So for the T1 and T2 lesions, they're very localized and are far enough away from the dentate line. Often these can be treated with surgery alone. The areas that have a lot more uncertainty are these larger T3, T4, or node-positive disease, where our chances of being able to resect everything gets a lot more difficult. Furthermore, low-lying tumors that are very close to the dentate line may also have a higher risk of being unable to perform a TME successfully. And this has led to a lot of interest about perioperative therapy, with the goal of either reducing risk of local recurrence with adjuvant therapy, and, as we'll explain, the modern approach being treating neoadjuvantly. Before going into the evidence for the perioperative trials, it's once again pointing out that these are trials that are run in collaboration between medical oncology, radiation, and surgery. And due to this, many of the studies have different inclusion criteria, different radiation methodologies, different surgical methodologies. And as a result, there have been varying opinions that have evolved, with approach in Europe being a bit different than what is typically done in the USA and the rest of North America.
An important point is that we usually want to treat based on the pre-neoadjuvant staging. So a lot of times this will rely on our MRI pelvis to get our T staging, as well as the lymph node and distant metastasis involvement. Things will obviously change once you have your neoadjuvant therapy, but we plan the whole course of treatment based on the pre-neoadjuvant staging.
The reason for consideration of perioperative therapy is that the majority of areas of failure in the historical trials was due to local recurrence. Tumors with their T3 or T4 node positive had a risk of recurrence of about 25 to 50%, with the predominant location being locally. The story of the perioperative treatments is also done by a number of trials that are often identified by their country of origin. So we will often be naming these based on the country that the trial was run, and we always recommend that you take a look at the show notes to get the citations for all these landmark trials. One of the major trials that has helped determine the absolute benefit of adjuvant therapy was the Dutch study. And this used what is known as the short course of radiation, which is giving 5 gray and 5 fractions, so just 5 days of radiation therapy followed by surgery. In addition to the study showing a 50% relative risk reduction using radiation versus surgery alone in terms of local recurrence, it also broke down which tumors were most likely to benefit. Overall, in the total population, the risk of local recurrence at 2 years was reduced from 8% to 2.4% with the addition of radiation compared to TME alone. This was not an evenly distributed benefit, and we found that tumors that were close to the dentate line had a more significant benefit, such that those beyond 10 centimeters were less likely to show significant recurrence. And by stage, those that were stage 3 were most likely to benefit, with a local recurrence rate to decrease from 15% to 4.3%, and those within 5 centimeters of the dentate line having a risk of recurrence decreasing from 10% to 5.8%. Overall, the relative risk reduction was about 50%. Survival was similar between these two groups, and this will be a similar parallel showed for many of our of these studies where survival is not significantly increased in the vast majority of trials. However, often we have an improvement of local recurrence. And this has been determined to be a clinically significant endpoint because preventing need for secondary surgery and ostomy placement has a significant impact on patient health morbidity.
The study actually included patients with all stages of rectal cancer. Not surprisingly, there was no difference in local recurrence in patients with a stage 4 disease with the addition of neoadjuvant radiation, and as well as patients with stage 1 disease, the hazard ratio was 1. In another follow-up study to this one, what we're calling the Swedish trial, had about 1,100 patients. It's looked at a similar regimen of 5 days of radiation with 5 gray each day, followed by total mesorectal excision versus just the TME alone. And this one also showed a decrease in local recurrence. So at 5 years, the recurrence rate was 11% in patients that had radiation versus 27% in patients that had surgery alone. So kind of, again, supporting the utility of neoadjuvant radiation. This study was actually one of the very few studies that did show an overall survival benefit at 5 years. So at 5 years, the overall survival was 58% in the radiation group versus 48% in the surgery alone group. So although many of the other studies have not showed overall survival benefit, just to point out that this one actually did have a small but statistically significant overall survival benefit at 5 years.
The fact that this did show a survival benefit and the vast majority of other trials, especially those using long course, which we'll be discussing momentarily, did not, is one of the reasons that in Europe there's been a trend towards preferring the short course regimen, among other reasons. Now, in contrast to what we call short course radiation, we have the, well, long course. No middle course, but we have a long course. And in this case, we're using approximately 6 weeks of radiation, giving a lower dose on a daily basis. For weekdays for a total of 6 weeks. This had similar benefits in its early trials, showing reduction in local recurrence. One thing that long course radiation has shown, and this was shown in the French trial, was that combining chemotherapy with long course radiation has an added benefit. And in the French trial, which used the full long course radiation versus the radiation plus a 5-FU-based chemotherapy regimen, was able to further reduce 5-year local recurrence from 11.4% to 3.6%. And although concurrent chemotherapy has never been shown to benefit short course radiation, in general, this would be the standard these days to include with your long course radiation.
Yeah, I always thought it was weird that they called short course versus long course, because that makes it seem like the only difference is the timing. I know when I first started GI clinic, I thought that was the only difference and that there was chemotherapy in both long and short course. But short course is just radiation, whereas long course is chemo radiation.
And the original trials using chemotherapy with these used a 5-FU-based treatment, either as a bolus or as a 5 days continuous IV infusion. For convenience sake, capecitabine has been shown to be as good as, and I think it'd be fair to say that the standard of care now for anyone getting long course radiation would be getting capecitabine BID on days of radiation, as this avoids the need of wearing a pump continuously for 6 weeks. Another trial worth noting is the Polish trial, which did compare long course versus short course using a chemotherapy-based long course of radiation and versus a short course, and this was trying to show whether or not long course radiation had superiority. Ultimately, this did find that the disease-free survival was relatively similar regardless of the radiation regimen that was selected, and overall survival remained similar at long-term follow-up.
One of the questions was, is it more useful to give this chemo radiation in the preoperative setting versus in the postoperative setting? So this was addressed in what we're calling the German trial, which had about 800 patients, and it looked at preoperative chemo RT with a 5-FU-based infusional, so the study did not use capecitabine, plus radiation for about 6 weeks, 28 fractions. In the preoperative versus the postoperative setting, it is worth noting that all patients in this study had 4 cycles of additional postoperative just chemotherapy with 5-FU. So this was looking only at patients with stage 2 and stage 3 disease, because as we've seen, the benefits so far seem to be better in these groups. So only patients that were T3, T4, or node positive. And this study did show benefit in the preoperative chemo RT group. They had decreased local recurrence at 5 years, so 6% versus 13%, And this continued when they did a follow-up study at 10 years, although the benefit was a little bit less at 10 years, 7% versus 10% local recurrence. Also, another important quality of life endpoint, there was increased sphincter preservation. So they initially asked the surgeons what type of surgery they would need. And among patients that were initially thought to need an APR, which would require permanent ostomy, 39% of them were able to get a sphincter sparing surgery in the preoperative group versus only 19% in the postoperative group. There was no overall survival benefit seen to the pre-op versus post-op group.
There was a parallel trial run in the United States, run by the National Surgical Adjuvant Breast and Bowel Project, the NSABP, which used a very similar design and also had similar findings showing a significant disease-free survival benefit out to 5 years. In that study, the rate of disease-free survival is 64.7 versus 53%, which is quite similar to the 68 versus 63% in the German trial. This also did not show an overall survival, although there seemed to be a trend in those receiving neoadjuvant regimen. Another thing it's worth noting is more people were able to complete the neoadjuvant regimen because those recovering from surgery are less likely to tolerate chemotherapy and radiation. And one of the hypotheses for why these neoadjuvant regimens are more effective is due to the fact that we're able to give more drug and radiation to the patient.
There have also been trials. If you remember going back to our colon cancer talks, the addition of oxaliplatin to 5-FU has also helped increase overall survival and decrease local recurrence. They have looked at this in rectal cancer. There was another NSABP trial looking at the addition of oxaliplatin to 5-FU, and this actually showed no benefit, so no decrease in recurrence-free survival or overall survival.
Yeah, there's been a few attempts to try to intensify the chemoradiation regimen, and nothing has been better than good old-fashioned 5-FU or capecitabine-based treatment.
So another thing to consider is the timing of the surgery. So after you give the chemo radiation, when do we take these patients to surgery? There was another trial looking at this called the Stockholm trial. And this study had 840 patients. It randomized patients to either short course radiation only with immediate surgery versus short course plus delayed surgery and then long course chemo radiation with delayed surgery. The study showed a benefit with an increase in pathologic complete response with short course radiation with delayed surgery, as well as would be expected, decreased surgical complications when you have delayed surgery. So in patients that are getting short course radiation, we tend to prefer delayed surgery rather than immediate surgery. And one of the reasons for this is that it can take about 4 to 6 weeks for us to see the full benefits of radiation. So if you give someone short course radiation or long course chemo radiation, you generally want to wait 4 to 6 weeks prior to restaging to see, you know, where you're at before the surgery.
So before we move into some questions regarding adjuvant systemic therapy, I think worth breaking down. So for tumors of T1 or T2, we can often go with surgery alone. If there's a risk of the tumor being close to the dentate line, or for stage 2 or stage 3 tumors, you're going to be considering giving some sort of perioperative therapy. Due to the results of the NSABP and German trial, this will almost exclusively be given in a neoadjuvant manner. Whether or not you go with a long course with concurrent chemo radiation or a short course of just 5 days of radiation will likely depend on your center's preferences. With some delay until after completing radiation surgery, there's a chance that you may be able to downstage somewhat. And ultimately, the goal is going to be to achieve a transmesorectal rectal excision, at which time the pathology will be analyzed and you'll get your YP staging, if you recall back from our prior discussions on neoadjuvant pathologic staging.
And that really, this is all to decrease local recurrence. Aside from the Swedish trial, none of the studies have shown that any of this neoadjuvant treatment has decreased distant metastatic disease or overall survival.
And that's really where the thrust of the research has been more recently, and we'll next discussion get into a lot into total neoadjuvant therapy, trying to intensify the neoadjuvant treatments. But currently, our best data that's worth discussing right now is the role of adjuvant therapy. And unfortunately, in rectal cancer, the data for adjuvant therapy is somewhat lacking and has not really shown the great improvement on what our goal is, which is to reduce distant recurrences. One of the reasons for this is there's been a lot of variability in the intensity of adjuvant therapy, as well as patient inclusion criterias and control groups. And I think the best study, which I think is the one worth discussing right now, would be the ADORE trial. often the justification to use adjuvant therapy is going to be based upon our colon cancer literature, so using staging criteria, and for those patients who would be candidates for adjuvant therapy should this have been a higher colon cancer, would be often considered for some sort of 5-FU or FOLFOX based regimen in the adjuvant setting. Although there's been some conflicting opinions on which patients are most likely to benefit from this, there's some good data showing that the clinical staging does not necessarily reflect outcomes, and that this is likely due to a lot of the inconsistencies between assessments on the pelvic MRI and limitations of that modality. I'm not sure whether or not patients who have the least amount of response at the time of surgery are going to be the best candidates for adjuvant therapy, those with no change in their tumor needing more intensified therapy, or is it those that get that pathologic complete response who are showing to be most treatment sensitive that are going to benefit the most?
Yeah, that's a good point. I feel like sometimes if someone achieves a pathologic complete response with a neoadjuvant treatment at surgery, there's always a question, do they even need treatment? But on the other hand, it seems like those patients had the biggest benefit from chemotherapy.
Especially with the knowledge that we haven't done anything to reduce the rate of distant recurrences and understanding that there may be micrometastatic disease, we really want to target those really sensitive tumors that are most likely to benefit from treatment. With that in mind, we'll skip over many of the older trials and focus in on the most recent one, which would be the ADORE trial, which is the only randomized trial looking at full FOX versus 5-FU, and this specifically to rectal cancer patients. And this was a phase 2 trial that took patients who received neoadjuvant concurrent chemoradiation, so long course chemoradiation, who then went for surgery, and randomized them into either receiving full FOX or 5-FU for a total of 4 months. Patients were considered for this trial if they had residual disease, so YPT4, IPT3, or node-positive disease. And they did find an improvement in three-year disease-free survival of 71.6 versus 63% favoring the full FOX arm. No overall survival benefit was noted.
Yeah, I like this trial because they randomized patients after the surgery, so you kind of avoid the problems that we've seen in prior studies where a good amount of people after the surgery don't even end up getting the adjuvant chemotherapy. They picked patients that, you know, were doing well after the surgery, so that way the majority of them were able to actually get the chemo after surgery. Even though they only used patients with post-operative stage 2 or 3 disease, so, you know, patients that still had residual disease. So it doesn't really answer our question, you know, what do we do with patients that have a pathologic complete response at surgery? Right now, the standard is that we still offer these patients adjuvant chemotherapy, although this study does not really address that question.
And we certainly have skipped over a number of trials that did look at other regimens. However, I think that in the modern era where we're now talking a lot more about total neoadjuvant therapy, which once again we'll get into next episode, a lot of these older negative trials that were unable to show significant disease-free survival benefit using 5-FU monotherapy, or comparisons of different variations of these adjuvant therapies, are not as valuable to our time. And I'd recommend you, if you're interested in the history of these other trials, to take a look at one of the many good reviews that are currently available. So I don't know about what the approach that you've been seeing, Ryan, or that you've learned, but in general, I've tended to think of it as if a patient has enough advanced disease that I'm thinking about downstaging or trying to improve outcomes with neoadjuvant concurrent chemoradiation or radiation alone, usually those patients are ultimately going to be recommended for an adjuvant course of treatment, with some exceptions.
Yeah, I agree. You know, any of those stage 2 or 3 patients that were getting neoadjuvant, the vast majority of these will also get adjuvant chemotherapy, regardless of the response to the neoadjuvant. Okay, so some take-home points for today. So for stage 1 disease, we can often get away with just resection alone for these localized rectal cancers.
And for more advanced tumors, you're going to be using some form of neoadjuvant radiation, either as 5 gray and 5 fractions, or as the quote-unquote long course, which is 6 weeks of radiation with concurrent capecitabine given on days of radiation. The goal of both of these neoadjuvant regimens is to reduce disease-free survival and increase the chance of being able to successfully perform a transmesorectal excision, which allows patients to preserve their bowel functions. Although these regimens can improve local recurrence, distant recurrence remains a complication, and there's been attempts to improve overall disease-free survival with the use of adjuvant regimens. However, these have yet to be able to show a significant benefit to overall survival. However, for any patient with a high enough risk of recurrence that they're recommended a neoadjuvant chemoradiation approach, they should at least be considered or have a conversation about the potential benefit of adjuvant therapy in that setting.
I think that's it for today. Our next episode, stay tuned, we'll be talking about total neoadjuvant therapy, as well as the new and exciting dostarlimab study that was presented at ASCO this year. That's been kind of all over the news, so we'll get into the details of that trial as well for patients with MSI-high cancers.
These neoadjuvant and with the goal of non-operative approaches have been a really hot topic, and since 2019 have been major components of the ASCO conversations, with the most recent dostarlimab trial making its way into the New York Times. So many of you who are in practice have probably had many patients already asking you whether or not they can have a surgery-free approach. And although there's a limited number of patients that can benefit from this, it's certainly an exciting trial, and we look forward to discussing in more detail next time.
Thanks for listening, as always. And again, please let us know if you have any Facebook. Oh my God, Facebook. Thanks again for listening. And again, please let us know if you have any feedback. You can send us an email or a Twitter message or post. For more information, follow us on Twitter at Talking Tumors, or feel free to email us at talkingabouttumors@gmail.com.
Please rate and review the podcast. We really appreciate it.
And special shout out to our friend John Kim for all of his musical talents.
And he is the composer of the music that you're hearing right now. Talking About Tumors is not medical advice.
For medical advice, please contact your own healthcare provider.
The opinions stated on this podcast are by the Ryan who said it and no one else. We have no financial disclosures, and this is done purely on our own time to the sake of our enjoyment of the field of medical oncology. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.